This is the last talk of the conference and the workshop, so I have the last word. It might not be the best word, it's the last word. This is the contents of my talk, introduction, modified gravity, which I call MOG, which can mean Moffat gravity or modified gravity. fitting galaxy rotation curves and clusters, bullet clusters, cosmology, including some of this legal quickly because I have a lot to say. These are the ingredients of the standard cosmology. General relativity, large scale homogeneity and centropy, 5% ordinary matter, baryons and electrons, 25% dark matter, 70% dark energy, and uniform CMB radiation with a temperature of 2.73 degrees, and a scale free adiabatic fluctuations of order 10 to the minus 5. As we've heard for a week, the dark matter and dark energy are the most puzzling parts of the standard cosmology. Indeed, it's probably one of the most important problems in physics. Why is 96% of the matter and energy of the universe invisible? This is an extraordinary statement, considering that we've been talking and thinking gravity since the Greeks, through Aristotle and Newton and Einstein. And this is quite remarkable. Today I'm going to concentrate much of my time on the issue of the dark matter. And I will also discuss, of course, the dark energy. Dark matter and dark energy are inferred from the motion of visible matter in the gravitational field. It's possible that dark matter doesn't exist and that Einstein's general relativity has to be modified. Is this possible? Yes. So what I'm going to embark upon is an intellectual exercise to see whether I can get rid of dark matter. Because we don't see it. No one's ever detected it, and possibly we never will detect it. Pointed out by Costas Skotos, there's a whole history of dark matter versus gravity over the last, since 1900 or so, before that, 19th century, the perturbations of Uranus, the mass of Mercury, the very air, Vulcan, and Neptune, and so on. So, the equivalence principle implies a metric. And GR is the term unique in the four-dimensional spacetime. To modify GR, we either change the Einstein-Hilbert action, Sudermann geometry, or add new fields. The new fields may be dynamically sourced by ordinary matter, baryonic matter, as I call it, modified gravity. Now, Einstein's theory, let's get this straight. Einstein's theory is a beautiful theory. We love it. And it's robust. Why would I want to change it? The reason can be observation. So let me make a very different statement. If dark matter doesn't exist, if dark matter exists, then we keep Einstein gravity. That is, if we can detect that dark matter and really show that there's stable particles that compose the dark matter in the universe. Great, we keep this wonderful theory. Okay. If dark matter doesn't exist, as I will show, there is enormous evidence for the fact that we have to modify Einstein gravity. There's no way around it. A fully relativistic modified gravity mod called metric skewed tensor gravity. This is MGT and metric skewed tensor gravity, or scalar tensor vector gravity, STVG, Based on self-consistent stable gravity theory, I can describe solar system astrophysical cosmological fate. I should point out that I published my first modified gravity theory in 1979. The title of the paper was A New Theory of Gravitation. And in those days, there weren't many modified gravity theories. And people weren't happy about me publishing the paper in the Physical Review because they said, why would we want a new gravity theory? What's the point of this? It's not as beautiful as Einstein's theory, etc. In the meantime, I've got my NGT, non-symmetric gravity theory, down to the simplest form, which can fit all the data that I'm going to describe to you. Now, the STVG theory has an extra degree of freedom, a vector field called the fine field, whose curl is a skewed field that couples to matter. It's actually a fifth force. The gravitational field is described by symmetric Einstein-metric tension. The effective classical theory allows the gravitational coupling constant G to vary as a scalar field in space and time. The effective mass of the skewed symmetric field and the coupling of the field to matter also vary in space, time, and scalar fields. This is an effective description of renormalization group flow behavior of these constants. The variations of the constants, as just mentioned, can be explained in the quantum gravity theory of a renormalization group flow scenario in which gravity is an asymptotically free theory. This has been discussed much by Reuter and his collaborators over the last decade. The modified Newtonian acceleration law for weak fields can fit a large amount of galaxy rotation curve data without non-baryonic dark matter, as I'm sure. This work was done with Joel Brownstein, who is present in the audience. The modified acceleration law is consistent with the solar system data and can possibly explain the pioneer 10, 11 enormous acceleration applications of Joel Brownstein. Now, MOG must also explain the following efficiency. The CMB data, including the power spectrum, the formation of proto-galaxies in the early universe and the growth of galaxies. Gravitational lensing data for galaxies and clusters of galaxies. The bullet cluster, 1E06.65756. N-body simulations of galaxy surface. The accelerating expansion of the universe. This is a big deal. Now, once you have a consistent action principle, and you claim the theory is consistent, then the success of the theory depends on how much data you fit. Now, the standard model of particle physics has 18 to 22 fringe parameters, depending on how you count. It's considered one of the most successful theories in physics. The reason being, of course, that it fits a large amount of data, and no experiment to date has shown to be wrong. The action takes the following form. And this is the action principle. The degrees of freedom are the metric tensor of Einstein gravity, this mass electric field pioneer. Three scalar fields, big G, omega, and mu. Omega is the coupling of the vector field of mass. Now, this theory is stable. So one of my criteria for choosing a mark is that it has to be stable. I don't want the sun to last only a week or 2 weeks. The theory has to be stable, produce a stable universe. This is not trivial. Almost all modified gravity theories are unstable. This is not, nor is Brown-Stickin. Brown-Stickin is normal form, is a stable gravity theory. There are no ghosts, tachyons, the Hamiltonian is bounded from below. And I saw these the equations here for static spherical symmetric field, and I get this modified Newtonian acceleration law, where alpha is a running constant, coupling constant, function of r, and lambda is the running range, this acceleration law. So I can re-express effectively the modified Newtonian acceleration law in this way, where I know what g is. Now, the as I mentioned, these the alpha and the lambda, and which I express as 1 over r sub 0, run with distance in the renormalization RG flow form. And when empirically we find that they run this way. This is n naught here versus r naught. These are the two parameters that come into the modifying Newtonian acceleration law. And empirically, this is what we find. Clusters of galaxies, dwarf galaxies, dwarf clusters, galaxies, and dwarf galaxies. And then, of course, the solar system. So we fitted, Joel and I fitted 101 galaxies, rotation curves of 101 galaxies, using photometric data, and a core model of photometric data for 58 galaxies, core model for 43 galaxies. And the fits effectively depend on the mass to light ratio. You fix one galaxy with the two parameters, and then it has to fit all the others. And there are hundreds of galaxies that you can do this. You can keep going. Also, we fitted 106 X-ray cluster galaxies, and with the same modified Newtonian acceleration law. Now, in all the cases for the galaxies, as we'll see, our fits sit right on top of Milgram's modified Newtonian dynamics phenomenological law, which is remarkable. So my modified Newtonian acceleration law contains Milgram's law. But in contrast to Milgram, the rotational curves become Kepler Newtonian at large distances from the galaxies. And this can be tested on data for satellite, so-called satellite galaxies. So here are some of the fits. You can see the this is from the photometric data, we can get the disk and bulge and the gas, even 21 centimeter hydrogen line gas. And the black line is an STVG fit, and in there you can see the magenta line is the magenta curve is the Milgram fit. These are more fits. The fits are so good that they actually produce the kinks in the data. So anyone who claims to want to fit galaxy rotation curves with some modified gravity have to do as well as we do. But this is not trivial. People claim in the literature that, well, this modified gravity theory can get flat rotation curves. Most of the galaxy rotation curves are not actually flat, they're rising. But for large spiral galaxies, of course, they're flat. So the situation is quite complicated. You have to fit all of this with just the mass to light ratio. Here again.
How can you make the kink? How you produce the, kink?
Oh, but that comes because the astronomers gave us photometric data. You plug that in, and it gives you the kinks.
Yeah, but then how many parameters have you got? Sorry.
Well, we fit for the galaxies, we have two parameters, we fit it to one galaxy, and then it has to fit all the others. And you can fit hundreds. So effectively, there's just one parameter. Master language.
How do you get
one or two parameters? Well, because the Newtonian acceleration law works, if you wish.
Milton gets
as good as.
John, if you go back to the slide with the galaxy, you can focus on a kink and you can discover whether it comes from the gas or the stars.
Yeah.
Just sort of, if you take a look at NGC 1560, you can see there's a point where the Blackwood-Lemond cyan curve dips, and then taking a look at the data, which is the green gas or the magenta stars, you can see that there's a corresponding dip in the data.
So the kink is, so is it a input or a prediction?
It's a prediction.
Well, it's both. I mean, there's a kink there because there's a kink in the variant distribution. So the question is, can you map the kink you observe in the variant distribution to the kink in the rotation curve? And yeah, I mean, I guess I would argue about how significant that is because,
well,
you know, well, the position of the kink.
We can argue about this. Thank you. So we come to the famous Tully-Fisher law, which says that the power of the rotational velocity curve is proportional to the fourth power of the rotational velocity curve is proportional to the luminosity of the mass, which is not true in Newtonian gravity. And so we did a very extensive fit of the world's data, and we discovered that we actually predict the power, whereas a Milgram's model is built in as a fourth power. It was designed to give fourth. We found actually from fitting a lot of data that the preferred value is 3.22, not 4. We claim that's the right answer. So we claim that Milgram's result was not correct.
Is there a simple way to see that? The funny thing with the rotation curves is that they, for different size galaxies, it's kind of a fixed distance that the dark matter takes over, right? And it's a fixed acceleration, and that's why Mon does a good job of that. Is there a similarly simple way to see why you're capturing the acceleration of the parameter rather than the distance?
Well, the Tully-Fisher law is determined by the asymptotic value.
I'm worried about where it turns over to be.
Oh, okay. Well, there's a scale dependence. You just plug in the same two parameters, say, for the galaxy and spiral galaxy, and the scale dependence is correct. What can I say? It's the data. And you can analyze it by looking at the Newtonian acceleration law, and you can even extract Milgram's law for critical acceleration cases to return that. You can understand why we get the same good fits. So here we come to the clusters. We fitted 106 X-ray clusters. And these clusters are in thermodynamic equilibrium. So when you do an isothermal hydrostatic equilibrium analysis, you find that here, you find that, the black curve is outfit. The blue dotted curve and the magenta curve are new Einstein, is Milgram, Mond, and Newton, which don't fit the galaxy clusters, unless you put in dark matter. So the conclusion is that Mond doesn't fit the clusters or the lensing of that dark matter. There are arguments that you could put in electron mass, between electron mass, with a mass of 2 or 3 electron volts, and it fits. There is dark matter. Here there's no dark. Incidentally, if in this project I find that I have to start using a lot of dark matter, I'm going to quit. I really mean it. Because Einstein's theory is beautiful. So you stick to it unless you absolutely have to change the paradigm. And the paradigm changes through data, the way physics, astronomy usually happens. It's the data that drives the theory.
Well, the reason you managed to fit galaxies and clusters is really because of this alpha and lambda, right?
That alpha and lambda.
That's not derived from your classical equations of motion.
Well, yes, the two in effect, because the STVG has affected field equations, which determine the functional behavior of alpha and lambda. So in principle, if you could solve all the equations, everything would be determined. Of course, this is not easy to do. This is not easy to do.
Right? I mean, at some level, you're putting the...
Well, at present, I have to put in an empirical law for the running because we're not able to solve all the equations. It's not easy. So in the principle, everything is solved.
Well, in your function of G Newton, he has two functions, alpha and lambda of R. I think the functional form of that, you're sort of empirically putting it by hand so that G Newton is much larger for clusters than for galaxies.
I repeat that the standalone part of the physics is 22 free parameters. Well, in effect, the functional dependence of lambda and alpha is determined by the field equation.
In the cluster fits, there were no free parameters, and as a result, the fact that the functional form fit cluster by cluster could not have been accomplished through an actual programmatic fit because none was actually done. So alpha and lambda are not free functions, and they don't provide the freedom that you suggest that they are what's responsible for doing the fit. For the cluster fits, they were actually predetermined before actually doing the fit.
Well, that's fine, but you're not. What I'm saying is, the G Newton you showed at the beginning,
yeah,
I don't want to take over, but it's a very simple question. You didn't solve all the classical equations of motion to get that G Newton. You put a function by hand, which you sort of, you guess, maybe empirically, but...
So the fact that G Newton approaches an asymptotic value, which for galaxies is about 6 to 7, is also reflected in clusters, where the asymptotic value is also 6 to 7.
Yeah. You end up with an asymptotic value of G Newton, and a lambda, and
just so it's understood,
lambda not.
I'm just trying to follow the conversation, but there's these functions that are there fields that are being varied in the solutions to the equation of motion are known what the profiles are, or are there two functions that are being chosen a priori?
In principle, the lambda and alpha and g, the random field determined by field equations. Okay. However, at present, we only have empirical fits, as shown earlier.
So you're choosing them a priori, is what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah. In last August, NASA released a statement to the effect that dark matter had been proved to exist without any doubt. And this took me somewhat as a surprise. I thought, okay, game over. Dark matter has been proved in observation. So, but then I looked into it, and it forced me into solving the lensing problem for this mark. I had completely done at the time. And then I put out a preliminary paper saying, hold everything. This is not necessarily the truth. Let's be careful. I got onto a blog site with Douglas Club. They asked me to go on because there was a lot of argument. I'd never been on a blog site before. I didn't write a blog, but I did blog. So I got into a discussion with them. My final word was, the statement was that we are not in a position yet to definitely say that dark matter has been proved to exist. And that was the end of that blog discussion. So in the meantime, Joel and I have done extensive analysis of the blog and the Booth cluster data. And it's a paper we have. And in fact, it's probably one of the most extensive analysis of the data, which was kindly given to us by Claude and his collaborators. But you have to explain, so this is what it looks like. And this is the plasma gas, which through ramp pressure stays behind when the two clusters collide. This is the bullet, which is the shock wave running and moving at 3 Mach 3. And this blue part, which of course is an artist's interpretation, is the is where the galaxy's purported dark matter sits. Because the dark matter doesn't collide with anything, so it just runs through and without collision, so that the galaxies are apart. So what you have to explain, that lensing, weak and strong lensing coming from distant sources in the back here, can determine a map of the matter that sits here, in fact, throughout the whole of this object. By the way, this is the hottest object in the universe. It has a temperature of about 150,000 degrees centigrade, which is roughly the 15.5 keV. It's quite an extraordinary object. So, what we do is we treat the main cluster as an isothermal object and do a King model calculation of the density from the data. And then we put the Bode cluster on top as the perturbation. Bode cluster, of course, is not an isothermal in blue because it's a shock. So it turns out that, well, this is the data for the King model, get the density, we integrate the density to get the surface density, and from the surface density you get what's called the convergence map, which comes from the shear of the objects. The objects are distorted due to the lensing. And I mention again what the modified Newtonian acceleration law looks like. And what comes in actually is the asymptotic value of big G on the M node. And these are the lensing formulas. Now it turns out that in contrast to GR, the convergence map which determines the lensing for the emerging clusters has G sitting inside the integral. So this G that I just showed you, which we know from solutions of the field theory. And so it acts as a weighting function inside the integral over the density. This is a picture of the reconstructed from the X-ray imaging observations of the Bode cluster. And it shows the kappa peak. I did a painting of this, but I painted it. You can see it in my office. It's quite nice. Okay, so this is the King model result. The blue and the red show the fit to the data. And the fit is very good. So remarkably, the main cluster, is very close to isothermal equilibrium. Fortunately, otherwise I couldn't show you the results. Here we are. This is the King data model, and this is the data. And the Bode cluster sits on top here. This is showing the plot of the running G divided by Newton's constant. This is a cartoon picture, which is an unrealistic picture, but it's trying to show you what happens. Here we have two Gaussians. I use two Gaussians to produce this surface density. The red curve is from the X-ray gas surface density. The blue curve is the running big G. And you put that together with this density and you get this result. You get that the lensing is strong on the wings, which is possible to see. And this is what you get from Einstein on Newtonian gravity, which obviously does not fit the data. This is hydrostatic equilibrium stuff. We predict, our calculation predicts the temperature to be 15.5 plus or minus 3.9 keV, and accepted experimental value is 14.8 plus 1.7 minus 1.2. Remarkably good prediction. Here we have the final result. This is the data of the bullet cluster. This is our result. And the result of what we have, excellent fit, is obtained by having 17% of galaxies in the wings, right there, in the blue part. 17%, that's the prediction. It gives us a perfect, almost perfect fit. And we also did dark matter, of course, the model. And for the dark matter model, we find that, because you have a lot of dark matter, which we don't have, of course, and the number of galaxies is less than 4% of the wings. Of course, you have to do observations of galaxies in the blue part. This is not good. So we actually have a prediction that you should see 70% galaxies. Okay, let's carry on here. So let's get to cosmology. I dealt in FLRW background spacetime, and here the asymmetric field is zero. Only the scalar part survives. These are the modified Friedmann equations I get. And you notice that there's a lambda sub g sitting here. This is from the running of g. And lambda g is given by this. H is the Hubble parameter. And g effective, it comes in here, with the generalized Friedmann equation, is given by this expression. So I have that g runs to an asymptotic value before equal division. And z is about 6. The number 6 or 7 keeps coming up in all the calculations, because that's the difference between dark matter and baryons, wherever you look in the data. So I have an explanation for the acceleration of the universe, because I'm mimicking the concordance spot. Now,
wait, there are... So what about nucleosynthesis?
Oh, okay. So
doesn't G Newton vary too much?
Yeah, this is the solution, model solution of the field equations. This is G over G Newton. And at nucleosynthesis, of course, G has to be G Newton in the 5%. So it runs from 1, at the redshift of 10 to the 10, whatever the temperature time is, up towards recombination. And then it comes down again towards the solar system.
So you kick it up to the right, it comes back down to about 10% of where it started.
So the correlation function for temperature differences, of course, is Gaia, given by this expression. And I use Slava Mokanov's formulation, which is a very nice analytic calculation of the oscillating peaks in the CMB. And so that I can see at every step where my modified gravity comes in. By the way, the speed of sound for recombination does not depend on big G, because it's a ratio of baryon density to radiation density. So you work it out, and I did a maiden calculation. I actually fitted the data with this. Results. And I get a third peak. The reason is that when you calculate SILCA, which that's erases structure, the SILCA goes like 1 over big G to the 3 halves power. So when you increase G by 7 to 10 G Newton, it decreases the diffusion random walk photon significantly. So you end up with enough power to get the third peak. So we fit the acoustical spectrum without collision as dark matter components. And the acceleration of the universe follows from this lambda g. So Einstein's lambda is zero. Now, this is the accelerating universe, as we've learned, is a confusing business. I have another model describing the accelerating universe, which we heard about, in the Lemaître-Tolman-Bond model, which totally contradicts what I have here. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I do this Thursday, Friday, Saturday, really orthogonal explanation, which I like better actually, because there's no coincidence problem. And but still, this explanation comes out of my mark, so I like that too. It's very schizophrenic. But this is the story of Dakinji. We obviously don't understand what we're doing, but being quite blunt, at least I don't understand what we're doing. Maybe you do, I don't. There are too many models. However, when you get this kind of activity and this pressure to understand, it means that we're possibly on the verge of a paradigm shift. So it's very important. It's a revolution in physics. In fact, even Einstein may be wrong. I'm standing here in May 2007 telling you that Einstein is not correct. It really means that we don't understand gravity. Okay, so now we come to instability, growth. You have to keep going, okay? The basic equation which I've worked out of the growth structure is this, and that is in a cartoon form. And when gravity dominates over pressure, you get growth. When pressure dominates over gravity, you get an oscillating Bessel function. So when you look at the data, you find, of course, that the oscillating Bessel function doesn't fit. But it turns out, it's sort of rather neat, that when you increase G, the asymptotic behavior of the running G, to 7 times G Newton, it drives the oscillating parts many times. It's speeding up the growth, which is what you want. And so I can fit this linear behavior. Well, it looks like we've come to the end of the story. So a stable, self-consistent modified gravity model is constructed from a similar value geometry, a massless Q field taken from the kernel of elasticity. And as I said, the stochastic solution gives you the running G modified Newtonian acceleration. We fit a large number of galaxies. And by the way, if you can just take my code, so code the job, put in another 100 galaxies, and you're going to fit them too. I guarantee you. It's quite remarkable. And in the case of dark matter, since you people worry about parameters, to fit the rotation curves of galaxies with the lateral Frank White mass profile, you need a triaxial mass profile in order to get rid of what's called the cusp problem. And this is three parameters, and you need three parameters for each galaxy, different from the given M over L. So for 101 galaxies, 100 galaxies could end up with 300 parameters. That's a lot of parameters. And yet dark matter models still exist. And you know what? I can't falsify dark matter. It's not satisfactory. It doesn't look great, but it's possibly correct. The standard model has 22 free parameters. So it's an unsatisfactory situation. We need to have some kind of data that really distinguishes between dark matter and my mod, or whatever mod you people start yourselves. At present, I don't think this exists. But there's now activity among astronomers to do more measurements on the emerging cluster. Able525 is one of them. So we get these labs, more of these labs, you've got more than one, just one experimental lab to work on. By the way, I didn't mention that one, 2 minutes, that there's another anomaly out there. The Pioneer 10 delivered anomaly. These are two spacecraft moving away in opposite directions in the plane of the solar system. And you've probably read it in the newspapers, Discover magazine. That there's an enormous acceleration, which is 4 orders of magnitude smaller than expected Newtonian acceleration at around 14 astronomical units from the Sun. I am a member of the NASA team that's investigating this. There's about 30 of us. And we had a meeting in February, the 3rd. We still haven't decided whether the anomaly is due to gravity or some systematic heat, maybe a heat shield effect. I think it's gravity. So we're able, with the new data that's been taken, to see whether the anomalous acceleration vector is pointing towards the Sun. We know it's pointing towards the Earth itself, not towards the center of the Milky Way. So if we can look at this small subtended angle and see if it's actually pointing towards the Sun, this means that Newton is wrong. Observation, I'm talking data, which is quite a dramatic thing. I'm talking about the solar system. So we published papers, and I discovered that general relativity is only really checked for the inner planets. For the outer planets, the data, the famous data, depends on optical data, not radar, laser ranging data. So GR and Einstein Newton are not really entirely well tested in the outer solar system, which came as a surprise to me. And this is now agreed upon amongst people who work with this stuff. So, and thank you.
So, do you know what happens to the baryon density in this model, or do you have any guess from nucleosynthesis? I mean, is nucleosynthesis affected?
The nucleosynthesis, a redshift of 10 to the 10, has to have G approximately 5% K mu, otherwise you don't get the right answer. So there are two boundary conditions on my running in G. One is that redshift of 10 to the 10, BPN, when G is approximately G mu, it comes up towards recombination asymptotically, the reach of sort of value of 7 times G nu, and then it comes down towards the solar system. And of course, G dot over G is what you measure the solar system from the Cassini observations and other observations. And it's approximately, it has a bound of about less than 10 to minus 11 inverse year, which is approximately what I get to solve the cosmological constant problem. Capital H times G dot over G divided by H squared gives you omega. So lambda, if you wish, omega sub G. You put that to 0.7, calculate G over G, and you get roughly 10 to the minus 11. It's quite remarkable. So.
I was a bit confused on the discussion of the Bollett cluster. Do you have the discussion of the Bollett cluster? How do you explain the difference between the baryons, which are sort of central, and the weak Lindsay observations, which are further out? I mean, how does that?
It has an 8 sigma displacement from the center of gravity. That's what you have to explain. So and it's done because you plug in the G, which I know, big G, you plug it into that integral over the density, and it weights. It weights the integral. Because in Einstein gravity, G is just G nu, and it comes outside the circumference. So it weights it. So when you calculate it on a computer, out comes the Lindsay. It's like a non-local effect.
Well, what is the weighted in that particular direction? Do you have to pick an axis for it to be weighted along, and then why does it choose that direction to pull?
Well, we have an spherically symmetric solution at the moment. But my Poisson equations, and I write them down, are not spherically symmetric. So apparently, now there's 3D data, which we can use. Three-dimensional data. So the whole thing can be done by plugging in the 3D data to the density. And the whole thing will be done in a kind of general way, which is quite exciting. But I expect you're going to get the same answer, because it's a very special solution. The main cluster is a proof of cluster solution. So it works. Take our code and do it, and find it gives the answer.
mentioned the beauty of Einstein's theory, and that we should only think about doing something, I mean, departing from it by data. So let's, for a moment, just for a second, forget about all these evidence for dark matter, from nuclear synthesis, from CMB, from clusters, and so on. Let's just take the rotation curves. As you might know, there's a model, a concrete proposal, just taking general relativity to get a flat rotation curve, which would not be
trivial,
but in addition, get also in addition, get a realistic density profile on it.
Yeah.
So what do you think?
Okay, well, first of all, I don't believe in Cooperstock's result.
I mean, there's seriously challenging this, because there are technical problems, singularities in the...
Well, there's also, there's a lot of problems.
Of course, but just as an attempt, I mean, one could maybe...
Yeah, okay, let's say that there's a way to do it. But then you still have a problem, because if you take straight GR, it doesn't fit the lensing. It's way off by factors of 10 more. And so what are you going to do about that? You fitted the galaxies, but all the lensing, there's a huge amount of lensing there, the bullet clusters of them. You see, this is the thing. When you construct these logs, everything has to work.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
And by the way, I forgot to mention that there's a University of Durham, but I'm a secretary. I talked to Carlos Frank, director of the Law Institute, and they have this huge computer called 3D N-body simulation. So he wants to put my log in using just baryons instead of dark matter particles and running it to see whether you get the galaxy survey data, which of course you do from dark matter models. And we have a suspicion that it will work. We talked about it. But that's the last hurdle. And this has to be done. If that doesn't work, I quit, because it's not working, okay?
One last question.
Sorry, just to come back to this point about variance, because we didn't sort of get where I was going quite. So one of the things that puzzles me generically about theories where the baryons source gravity is that most of the baryons aren't in galaxies. Galaxies have a minority of the baryons in them. Most of the baryons are outside of galaxies. So already, if someone said to me baryons source gravity and they produce rotation curves, that would tell me nothing about what rotation curves look like on large scales, because I wouldn't know what the baryon distribution was on large scales. So in a sense, I could put in other things. I mean, if you found, for instance, as you went out further with, say, satellite galaxies, kinks in galaxy rotation curves that weren't traced by variants, I could easily say there's low-density gas there that produces those kinks.
Yeah,
just to finish my point. So, you know, a third or less of the baryons are in galaxies. On the other hand, from chemical abundances, most of the baryons have to go through star-forming regions. I mean, it's not that the gas is sitting out there pristine. So one generic problem I have is if you make a structure of baryons where all the gravity is sourced by baryons, how do you then get rid of two-thirds of the mass in that object and put it back out into the cosmos, which is what we think happens at CDM, right? All the baryons go in, and half to two-thirds of them get ejected, given body star formation and AGN. So I'd be interested to see in these models, if you just make a very simple spherical model of shells and inject energy into it from supernovae or whatever, can you explain how the outer bits would be dynamically unstable, and you'd be able to lose, say, half the mass of the system and not, you know, disrupt the thing completely? So I mean, that would be an alternate test.
Well, these are tests that you can perform on this model, which has not yet been done.
Mm-hmm.
But out there, most of the visible matter is in the bulge of the disk. It's a flat disk in the spiral. By the way, you can approximate the flat disk by an ellipsoid or a sphere. That's the way it works. But what's producing the flat disk curves out, you know, on the edges of the spiral galaxy is the gas. right? It's the gas.
Yeah, but even if you take all the gas, it's mm-hmm. still, you know, a third or less of all the baryons. And the other baryons
yeah.
out there, you can see through quasar lines of sight and so on. So you can tell that they've been enriched with metals. And you can tell they're clumped together and so on. So you have to have all that material go in and then come back out, which is easy to do in CDM because it's not the source of the gravitational potential. So you can take a big gravitational potential energy you have, and as long as you manage to give it to this small amount of baryons, you can get them out very easily. But if they themselves are the source of all that energy, it's just conceptually hard to understand how a structure forms and then blows itself apart. And yet leaves this remnant with, you know, a nice quantity of mass.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying it's impossible, but it is no. definitely a distinct test.
The problem is that we don't understand enough about the evolution of galaxies, how they evolve to what they are, and also, for example, clusters. So you have to have a model of the evolution of the galaxy, as you described. These are complicated things. So I'm more than happy if you can produce a test that tells me the dark matter really exists, so I'm convinced. I haven't seen one yet. There's no observational test that tells me the dark matter exists. I've shown that. So it's a very interesting question. It's an amazing question. Because if I'm right, then I can tell my granddaughter, 9, that what she sees is actually what the universe consists of. And she'll say, well, of course, grandpa. Otherwise, it remains a total mystery. Because there's something like $8 billion going into CERN, LHC, to see, among other things, dark matter. And there's a huge effort in underground experiments to see dark matter. And so far, there is no evidence of the existence of dark matter. So history could repeat itself. It could be that it's the position of Neptune, anomalies of Uranus, and the various. Go and look there for that dark matter. And he did, and he found it. On the other hand, with the various anomalous acceleration of like anomalous perihelion precession of Mercury, he really believed that Vulcan existed. And you know, it took 66 years to resolve it. And even on his deathbed, Tiberius said, I really do believe Vulcan exists. But then Einstein's modified gravity, it's a mark. Modified Newtonian gravity. Solve the problem. So which way is it going to go? History will tell.
So that's...
I have to...